the hemorrhagic colitis outbreak, finding the Z. coli. Why me? You actually rotate, when you get sent out on outbreaks. There's like, I can't remember how many of us were in there. I think there were like 5 or 6 of us in that branch. So when this outbreak came up, it was my turn to go. Somebody else could have gone. And that person would have been the one to have, made the discovery. But it was my turn. So again, that was serendipity. One serendipity also influences another too. I think there's also, there's a series of I guess that's true with anything in life, but even the basic science work itself too, there are these serendipities that influence what takes place next. And this invasion protein that we identified, and we never thought that it was going to lead to a totally new way of developing vaccines when we discovered it. Why is it that Salmonella enteritidis happens to be the most important serotype of Salmonella, foodborne disease in right now in the U.S.? Because that's the perfect bug to apply this technology to. It just happens that the transmission occurs from chickens to humans, and we wanted to develop a vaccine for chickens. Even now, as we talk about this, you have this influenza thing going on in chickens in China.
Right.
I just suddenly thought of applying this technology to influenza in chickens. I mean, this is a totally new approach to preventing the problem of influenza, because if indeed humans get infections from chickens or from domesticated animals in China, these vaccines could be applied to all kinds of animals.
And are you undaunted by jumping into such a fray?
No, because it's connected to what I'm already doing. It's not, the nice thing about moving to a new institution is that you have an opportunity to move into a new field. Because you're really provided with the resources to be able to do that initially, and you have sort of a certain flexibility, and it's also just temporarily. It's a new opportunity to get into new areas because you've switched the institution, it's kind of an excuse to get into new areas as well as being in a new institution, and vaccine is something that I've always been interested in. In fact, it's quite relevant to the School of Public Health. It's a one most important prevention modality that you can develop. But you need technology to be able to, you need basic science to be able to do that. And we have that knowledge base. We already have in my lab enough knowledge base to be able to develop vaccines. And we also have enough knowledge base in the field to apply the vaccines that we develop. So we have everything to be able to do it. And we have the resources, the School of Public Health, the epidemiologists who, much more sophisticated epidemiologists who can really help us with the study designs in the field, and we can offer our field sites to be able to do these things. So everything is here to be able to do those things. But very often, what happens is if you have the epidemiology resources, you don't have the people to be able to do the technology work. If you have the technology, because they don't have enough knowledge base to be able to apply it anywhere, they don't have a field site. So it's not that difficult for me to apply this immediately to do something, influenza in China. In fact, of course, I have to collaborate, with people. I can't do that myself. I don't have enough people in my lab to just really get into that. But certainly, if there's somebody's doing an influenza virus work, we just communicate, I have this plasmid. Would you like to make, an expression library for proteins with this plasmid and then study it in chickens? And so that can be done. We already have collaboration with another virologist here to try to develop CMV, vaccines and herpes virus vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so, it just sort of blossoms. And again, these are, all serendipitous, it's not, I didn't think of it ahead of time to do this.
Mm. Well, I was in Europe when the BSE.
Right.
situation exploded, mm-hmm. and you know, and it came at a very critical political time for the European mm-hmm. countries, and we debated it amongst at a university that I was that had a biotech program, and I do the history of science, and it's and covered in the newspapers, and it became very clear that, to me at least, that it wasn't just about BSE and this disease. It was about politicians, and it was about economics, and it was about farmers, and it was about international diplomacy. Right. It wasn't just about science.
Right.
So what is the role, being in such a highly conspicuous position, whether it's because you do research on a vector that causes it has caused the death of children because they just happen to eat a Jack in the Box. It seems to me that this influenza virus is going the same way as BSE.
Right.
We don't really know what's going on. And this morning on the news, they showed pictures of the Hong Kong people, the Chinese, flocking to temples to pray for the souls of the chickens because of the potential. If they don't release their spirits, then, you know, the plagues, more plagues are going to inflict themselves upon Hong Kong. So what's the role of science and the scientist in these epidemics versus, say, the role of politics and international diplomacy? How do you keep all these things separate? Or can you? Am I seeing it wrong? Is it necessary to keep these things separate?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there are many levels I think you can sort of address this. As a bench scientist, bench scientists concerned enough or you know knowledgeable enough about the public health implication of these things. You know, a bench scientist may do something at the bench that would try to minimize this problem. So you attack it from a scientific point of view. But if you are an epidemiologist working in a public health department, I was like, talking to my friend who's a state epidemiologist here. You know, he's dealing with this obviously, and he's you know anticipating the potential introduction of this influenza virus from Asia. And he has to deal with this and deal with the potentials. And that he's also, you know, he was at CDC, you know, with me and trained as an EIS person, as a physician. So he has a different way of dealing with this. And then at the level of the CDC, you know, they have another level of dealing with this, and WHO is another level. And so I think it really depends on what you're doing in you know, I don't feel that I have to, you know, sort of make any publicity about the, you know, economic or political implications of this. I mean, it's not my role, and you know, I don't know enough about the politics to, or even the economics, to be able to say anything, or comment. But from a public health point of view, you know, at least I have some idea of how one might be able to prevent this, prevent this from getting even worse in terms of the epidemic, potential for an epidemic to occur. And, you know, I have some ideas about how to prevent this in the future, sort of long-term plans, which will have an economic impact as well. And I think there would be certainly an economic interest on the part of many groups, I think, to have a technology to prevent this, you know, sort of thing from occurring. So, but I don't know what the role of the scientist should be. I don't think, unless that scientist is really knowledgeable, I don't think it's the place of a scientist to really make, you know, comments. No. You know, there are scientists who are really in touch, I think, with the politics and the economic issues. And those people, by all means, you know, if they can be a spokesman, they should be spokesmen. Because then they can really speak from, you know, the science point of view too, and translate the science to the politicians and economists. And I think that would be important, but, you know, for myself, you know, I can't do that. You know, I get asked all the time, you know, but
right.
Mm-hmm, okay. You know, people call me up, you know, about these things, but I just stay with the science questions, and not get into the politics.
Well, I can only ask this question now on the path because of pose this problem because of the past couple of years, mm-hmm. and the changing public expectations and changing public knowledge of kind of the threat of new epidemics or, say, tuberculosis, mm-hmm. which was thought to be kind of a problem of the past, mm-hmm. is resurfacing. But we've had several books come out
right.
on the coming plague and the mm-hmm. hot zone, mm-hmm. and talking about uncontrollable viruses, mm-hmm. Outbreak, a very popular movie that mm-hmm. romanticized your mm-hmm. very role mm-hmm. of, you know, going out into the field mm-hmm. and discovering these new pathogens mm-hmm. and creating the laboratory techniques and the screening techniques to identify these and control these.
Right.
And, you know, there is this kind of facade of mm-hmm. of safety when there are all these bacterium mm-hmm. and viruses out there just waiting to mm-hmm. annihilate mm-hmm. the human race. Mm-hmm. And so the public expects more of a role from scientists mm-hmm. and physicians. Mm-hmm. Have come to expect, whether it's mm-hmm. true or not, because of the media. And how mm-hmm. do you react to these at least media depictions and kind of raised public awareness of mm-hmm. these new or perhaps just undescribed, previously mm-hmm. undescribed threats
yeah.
from bacterial and infectious diseases.
Mm. Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, when you deal with international work, these threats are there all the time. They've been there for hundreds of years. And so when people, started becoming concerned about this here in the last couple of years, I guess I have a very cynical view about this. they should have always been concerned with it.
Right.
I think there's a lot of hype right now. And it's a good hype because I think it does emphasize the importance of these issues. That's something they should have been thinking about all the time. But that concern is still not sufficient in the sense that they're concerned because they're worried about what's going to happen to people here in this country. You know, they think that these infectious agents are going to come into this country and then, you know, wipe everybody out. And I think that attitude, I think, is still not... that's a rationale to do something, you know. I mean, so you have these emerging infectious disease programs that are coming out of NIH and in the government agency and CDC. And the way to convince the Congress and the American public that this is an important area to have more research funding is because if we don't do something about this, it's going to come to this country. And that rationale, I think, unfortunately, is a practical rationale, but... it really doesn't get to the real issue. The rationale, it should be that these infectious diseases are all over the world. It doesn't matter whether it's in the U.S. or not. You know, there are people, kids dying from this, you know, all over the world. That's why we have to do this, not because it's coming to the U.S. And it's very difficult to convince the Congress or anybody else about this. And I think that's what scientists have to do. Scientists are convinced, but it's not because it's affecting you here in this country, but it's an important problem, you know, in places. And as long as those problems exist in other parts of the world, it's always going to be a threat to the U.S., if you want to think of it that way. So my feeling is that if scientists were going to do something about this, then you'd think of it globally. If they're going to try to sort of communicate this information to the lay public. I think they need to be able to convince the lay public in a more global picture, you know, global manner. But also at the same time, you know, there's a certain hysteria that gets sort of engendered, I think, you know, by these things too. And you know, I guess AIDS is a good example. You know, just all the early, you know, stuff. I mean, it still happens, but stuff that came out with, you know, the transmission of HIV and all the concerns, you know, about that. Even with TB, I mean, when I first came here to Berkeley, you know, it's amazing. This sort of unsubstantiated fear about TB, you know, in Berkeley campus itself, you know, just the rigor. I mean, it's good, but at the same time, it was a little excessive in terms of what I had to do to set the lab up just to do TB work. And even some of the biologists here, you know, just didn't know anything about TB and raised issues that were really irrelevant. Nothing to do with reality, about safety issues, you know, related to TB. You know, that I was very amazed that these highly educated, you know, people had very little knowledge, you know, about what's going on with TB and what TB is. And so if Berkeley professors didn't understand this, you know, how are we going to ever you know, have the non-academic lay public understand this sort of thing?
How do we?
I think this sort of things have to be this education has to be provided and when people are still young, you know, in junior high school, and college. I think the more there's very little, I think, emphasis on sort of public health, I think, even in medical schools and in college pre-med, I think, preparatory courses. And I think those things have to change. You know, I mean, that's just, I think, one thing I can think of, but... Yeah, there's just a better dissemination of you know, the information in these... Better, but also, you know, accurate, you know, dissemination of the information.
So when our American Nobel Prize winning scientists like Joshua Lederberg and David Baltimore stand up and also make very public pronouncements about the dangers of all these new viruses and our growing number of viruses, in your opinion, in your view, what is at stake when people like these scientists of their stature are also part of this kind of growing public awareness of the dangers of virology? Is it part of this hysteria? Is it part of the hype? Or is it part of a concern of scientists that this is really, there is something really there?
Well, that's a good question. I know this is a controversial area, and again, I have a slightly cynical view about this. I mean, I think, when Nobel laureates expound on these issues, I think part of it, I think, is you know, bring attention to the need for more research in this area. And that's real. I mean, there's very little research, I think, being done, really good research being done in these emerging infectious pathogens. And so having people like that serve as spokesman is very helpful, you know, for people doing the research. But in terms of the actual perceived threat to the general population, you know, I don't think that that's real. There's always a potential. I can't say that for every pathogen, but you know, there are certain things that's clearly true. There are certain organisms that are, you know, the drug resistant, you know, bacterial organisms that are, you know, rising in the hospitals and you know, running out of the antibiotics to be able to treat some of these newly emerging resistant organisms. That's a real threat. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of publicity about multi-drug resistant TB, even as recently as, you know, a couple months ago. But when you actually do the work, it's not that much of a threat. And, you know, I know some people will criticize me for saying this, but my feeling is that by emphasizing multi-drug resistant TB, they're de-emphasizing probably the more important issue of just TB in general, and there are more people killed by non-drug resistant TB than, you know, than drug resistant TB in the world. And the this emphasis on MDR TB, I think, is probably not completely valid, and they need to get at the more important issue of trying to understand why certain clones of TB are able to kill people, you know, more than others. And there are basic science questions that still need to be addressed related to TB, that the attention is sort of getting away, being taken away from those more important questions by emphasizing something that may not be a real threat. And there are many other examples, you know, like this. And all these viral, you know, threats like the Ebola virus, and no, those are not, you know, this has been going on for many years, you know, these sporadic outbreaks, and get more publicity about, you know, a few deaths. I mean, you know, nothing important, but you know, as we talk, you know, probably 30,000 people die of TB, you know, and that doesn't make it into the newspapers. And so, while I think the raising of the consciousness about emerging infectious diseases is important, it could be better streamlined to really then now focus on what's really important. And I think, you know, it's my own opinion. I think what should be considered important should be something that is globally important, and not just for the United States. You know, there are infectious diseases that are not even is never mentioned by, you know, these people who go around speaking on these speaking tours that are very, very important. And it's either they don't know anything about these things, or they, you know, that they don't think that is important in the U.S. And it's certainly true, it's not that important in the U.S. But, you know, we work with an infectious disease called leptospirosis in Brazil. Every year during the rain season, you know, hundreds of people come down with this, and 15% of the people die. It's predictable every year. And if we're seeing this, you know, if we know that 15% of the people are dying from this, and if we know what's going on, you know, why don't we do something about this? You know, why can't we do it? We have the knowledge to be able to do it. We have the resources to be able to do it, but it's not being done because it's, you know, it takes place in the inner cities of urban centers of, you know, Brazil. You know, the population, you know, that are not that important for, you know, the economy or the politics of, you know, the U.S. or even the politicians in Brazil. That's an emerging infectious disease. It was traditionally a rural disease, but it's just popping up all over Brazil in the urban centers because of the urbanization and the crowding and the lack of infrastructure. And this is something that's a major problem. But I don't think I've ever heard Josh Lederberg talk about that or any of these people. So there's a, I think, too much generalization and not enough specifics. I think that needs to be emphasized. So.
And in terms of your own work, when you identified this new hemorrhagic strain of E. coli, or perhaps this the multi drug resistant TB, and did you see this? How did you view these developments that you were identifying? Kind of a new new mutations in E. coli that were making it the virulence different or the pathogenesis different? Or did you see this as like a scientist discovering something for the first time that's always been there? You had the one case in 75 to
Right, back. Right.
But in terms of your own kind of understanding of the genetic potential of E. coli in these bacteria to mutate and cause something very mutate rapidly and cause a more pathogenic strain. How are you perceiving?
No, you know, I've obviously thought about that, and you sort of get an understanding of what may be going on many years later as you learn more and more about this particular organism. We know that, as I think I mentioned before, that this particular E. coli has a has a phage, a virus in it, that seems to that encodes a so-called Shiga-like toxin. So that gives this E. coli, a different characteristic in terms of its pathogenic potential. But that itself is not enough, obviously. And it really, it really has to do with industry in the U.S. E. coli 0587 is a disease of industrialized countries. You never see this in Brazil. You never see this in Africa. You don't. You may see it rarely, but it's a disease. It's popped up in the U.S., Japan. Japan had the largest outbreak of this in the history of this organism. More than 10,000 cases last summer. Samuel 96. Germany also had a big outbreak. Scotland has a big outbreak. England has some. So it's a really a disease of industry. If it wasn't for the mass distribution system that these countries have developed for their meat products, this disease would have never come up. You may have sporadic cases here and there, but it would never have been recognized as part of an epidemic. The only reason we even picked up this in Oregon in the first place was because it was part of this mass consumption of hamburgers in a fast food restaurant. There are thousands and thousands of hamburgers. If it wasn't for the fast food restaurant, it would have never been picked up as an outbreak. Because if it was, somebody bought a piece of hamburger meat in the supermarket, that person might have gotten sick, but that was only one person. And another person may be totally a different place. It was just there's this concentrated accumulation of the food product in a fast food restaurant in this system. That contributed to the outbreak, and to the recognition that it was an outbreak, and to us being able to do the investigation and then eventually identify the organism. But these genetic changes are occurring all the time in nature. Most of the changes, whenever we recognize it doesn't do anything to the humans, right? We only recognize it if it does something to the humans. So it's not a new discovery of a new organism. It's just that things are evolving all the time, and it would only be important if humans happen to get sick from it. And the humans can get sick from it by what humans do to nature and industry. This mass distribution of food, meat products, is just a good example of what happens. And so, that's one of my interests that I have, the infectious disease of technology. That there's a lot of things that technology influences that bring about these organs. Multi-drug resistant TB is an example of that. All of the resistant nosocomial pathogens, are an example of technology. If you go to Haiti, you don't see MDR TB because they can't afford to buy drugs to treat TB. Okay, you only see it in countries in mid-income countries where people can have enough income to buy the drugs, but they don't have the proper public health control measures to prevent those things. And so So that's why, you know, I do work in Brazil, because that's an example of mid-income countries where these, it's a clash of the old traditional infectious diseases, but there's a new technology that's coming in, and there's no control. Leptospirosis is another good example. You know, it's the urbanization just rapidly taking place, people coming into the cities. You have a disease that you didn't see before in these cities. It's a very fascinating area. It has to do with evolution of the pathogens and the genetics, but at the same time, it connects to what humans do to nature. That's
okay.
That's how I view about how this E. coli evolved.
Okay. We're going to be jumping around a little bit because today's
okay.
our last session, and
sure.
I just wanted to bring back probably pose a very cynical view of the situation in the United States, and is what's happening with this kind of growing awareness, and even say Nobel laureates making public pronouncements about new dangers of viruses and infectious diseases. Is this the biomedical community's way of, is this the new Cold War, perhaps, for the biomedical community, which had traditionally ridden the coattails of defense funding, and that when money was pouring in for basic scientists because of kind of the imperatives of the Cold War and the ability, the need to maintain, you know, a certain level of defense and that quantum physics really, you know, benefited from. And with the end of the Cold War, a lot of basic science seemed to lose ground in Congress in terms of justifying existence.
Right.
And so is this kind of the new plague or the coming plague, whatever the name of the book is, the kind of the quote, new Cold War for the biomedical community?
No, that was a good question. Again, you know, in this case, actually, the perceived threat of, you know, these the biological warfare may have some basis. At the same time, you know, this rationale can be used to, you know, increase funding from the defense, you know, department for doing people, you know, doing the research in infectious diseases. My feeling is that more than biological warfare, there's certainly a possibility of biological terrorism. You know, it doesn't have to be an outside country, you know, an enemy country. I think using biological warfare. I think more of the concern would be, you know, there's crazy people in the U.S., you know, putting some biological agents in the water system or, you know, that sort of thing. That those are real, and I think U.S. is not prepared to deal with those things. You know, they're prepared to deal with more traditional terrorism, you know, bombings and things probably, but I don't think there's been a real effort made to, you know, what do you do when that happens? You know, how do you deal with it? How do you respond to this sort of situation? So. And you know, I think those things are going to become more real. As you, you know, asked me earlier, you know, there are obviously people who are very knowledgeable about how these pathogens work, and you know, it's not a secret. You know, it's not like the you know, how you make a nuclear, you know, bomb. I mean, you know, anybody can do this with some, you know, basic knowledge, and so. You know, there's actually, you know, several examples of this already happened, you know, about the salmonella outbreak among this counterculture community in Oregon a long time ago. I forget the name of the, you know, they had that guru.
Yeah, I know, yeah, right. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And, you know, this person actually obtained the salmonella strain from ATCC.
Okay.
And then they infected people with it. You know, and, I don't know if she actually went through the whole thing, but, you know, was about to do it or something. And then, you know, the only reason they knew it was because ATCC keeps a record of certain markers in the organ. So, you know, this has happened already.
Yeah.
You know, that just happened to be salmonella, but it happened with some other, you know, organism. So, you know, they could have spread anthrax agent in the subway system in Japan instead of the gas.
Right.
So this could easily happen. I think, yes, there should be efforts made to prevent these things. So I think, yeah, those things are real. In terms of, you know, the biological warfare, I think the threat there is as probably as real as nuclear attacks. You know, I mean, it's going to do them just as much harm as it will do us. And so I'm not sure how real that is. But there's certainly, there is a lot of discussion now about, funding for potential biological warfare. And if that leads to more funding, that's all the better. Because, I think the other sources of funding for this kind of research are very limited. And if the Defense Department has money to distribute to do this, they should do so.
Okay, and to jump back to your own stored development as a scientist. I think we left off with you finishing up your postdoc at Stanford and you seeing yourself really as a bacterial pathogenesis scientist researcher. But you do choose to go to India for 2 years. And why do you go to India rather than, say, pursuing an academic position?
I wasn't ready. I wanted to go to India. I mean, I made my mind many years ago that I wanted to spend some time in India.
And why India?
I wanted to go to India. when I was at CDC, I spent 3 months in Bangladesh working on a cholera surveillance system. And at the end of the 3 months, I traveled for about 10 days in India. And at that point, I said, I want to come back here to work someday. It's a country, I think, that every human being on the planet has to go to before they die.
Why is that?
Otherwise, you can't say you lived on this planet. It's a fascinating country. I mean, it's the history, the culture, it's an amazing country, and I wanted to live there. So, at that time we didn't have any kids, but
you didn't have any kids.
No.
Okay.
No, when we went to India, we did.
Okay.
But when I first decided I wanted to go, and after the Bangladesh trip, I didn't have any kids, so I didn't even realize how complicated it was going to be when we finally ended up going. But I just wanted to go. It was just this, emotional attachment that I had, it happened. Let's say I was in Bangladesh in '83, so it happened 5 years later. So when I left CDC, as I mentioned, I asked them if anything comes up in India, I wanted to go. And it was also a good project. I mean, at least on paper, it was a good project. And it was going to also be led by, my former boss at CDC, Roger Feldman. And so, two of us ended up going. And it was actually also my good friend here, Art Reingold, was supposed to go too. But he had also just gotten started with babies, and and originally the position there were going to be three positions, but it turned out to be two. So he eventually withdrew. And, I had a 2-year-old and an 8-month-old when we went.
Goodness.
And it was a very frustrating experience, but I'm glad I did it.
And why was it frustrating?
Well, just, this was a project, it was called an India Biomedical Support Project, and so the money came from USAID, but it was designed by CDC, and I was put into a WHO program to run this, and it was dealing with an Indian institution called the National Institute of Communicable Diseases, which is sort of the equivalent of the CDC of India. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, U.S. has 200 million people, India has 850 million people. Mm-hmm. If CDC of the U.S. were there in India, they would not be able to do what it's supposed to do. So here we're dealing with this. So four of the worst bureaucracies in the world. And so it was very difficult to, you know, get things moving, get projects started, things that we wanted to do. So, but I still, you know, learned a lot. And, you know, it was a great experience. And we had, you know, a couple papers come out based on, you know, some of the things we started doing.
And were you able to set up some labs using molecular that were able?
Well, that's one of the things that I was trying to emphasize. You know, trying to show that you know, problems can be addressed by introducing molecular techniques. And we use one example of the Shigella. You know, the Shigellosis is a big problem, and we developed a synthetic probe, you know, for detecting Shigella, you know, from stool. And in fact, it was one of the thesis projects of one of the students there. So I helped him to develop. And it wasn't so much that, you know, just doing the work on Shigella. That wasn't the issue. You know, the salt march of Mahatma Gandhi, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was just a single act of walking to the beach, marching to the beach, and picking up the salt that eventually led to, that was the beginning of the end of British Empire. Just a very simple act, but it was a very symbolic act. And so my approach was to just come up with this one simple thing and have a paper come out from this institute in an international journal. That was the objective. By doing that, it brings recognition to that approach, but at the same time brings a recognition to the institute that they're doing this, and India is able to do this. And that was very important for them. And also, it facilitated, there's another institution that was next to this institute, to make these primers, the oligos. Because they were looking for, you know, these are, you know, scientists who were trained in the U.S. or Europe, you know, came back, they didn't know what to do. They had all this equipment, they had no application, they didn't know what to do with it. So we said, why don't we do this? And they got really motivated to, you know, do this, and it was addressing a real issue in New Delhi. And, you know, it gave them credibility. They can make these primers, synthetic primers, that was going to be used. And it brought recognition to that place. Now they supply the primers, you know, all over India. You know, they can make it. So it was just a very simple gesture, but it had a very big impact. And so that was why it was important to do that, even though, you know, it was just a very simple study.
So you aren't too far removed from your interest in Eastern philosophies, whether it's Near Eastern or Far Eastern.
That may have had to do with, part of my decision to go to India. Yeah, I wanted to be there.
And make your salt march. Okay. And what happened to you, the work that you were doing at the bench at Stanford?
So you got placed in the back burner for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't.
What were your concerns that this might be the make or break point, whether you're going to be able to re-enter
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
academic, right, career. Yeah, no, it was a concern. Although I wasn't totally committed when I was in India to go back into academics.
Okay.
Although, you know, Cornell was already interested in my coming at the time, but, you know, I didn't sign my name to anything yet when I went. I said I was interested, but, you know, because, you know, I still had the opportunity to go back to CDC or do other things too, or WHO.
Yeah.
So, even after India. And it really wasn't towards the latter half of my stay there that I decided to go to Cornell. You know, still because of apprehension of my wife to go back to Atlanta. So that, you know, CDC wasn't really an option for us. You know, WHO was a possibility, but that would have been a totally different type of career. We actually wanted to stay overseas even longer, and there was, you know, we had a chance to go to Thailand a couple of times when we went to India, and, you know, Jesse really liked it there. You know, I lived there before, and so, you know, I liked it there. And You know, so I was always joking, it would be great to, you know, to be able to do something here. And so about 6 months after I joined Cornell, CDC calls me up and asks me if I wanted to go to Thailand. I said, why didn't you tell me this, you know, 2 years ago? I would have gladly done so. But you know, it was too late.
Yeah.
So, no, that was always a concern, you know. Where was the field going to be, you know, after I went back and entered pathogenic E. coli pathogenesis field? You know, there are a few people in the world, you know, doing this. And, you know, so I had essentially two years of kind of, I had to fall back 2 years. But I was able to, you know, resume it as soon as I got back to Cornell. That was a project I resumed, and, you know, I was able to do it and get some funding, you know, to do that work. And so, and it, you also realize that in 2 years, science moves very slowly.
Okay.
It's really interesting. At least in that particular field, you know, it's moving very slowly. So, I was also, of course, kept in touch, you know, with the literature, even when I was in India, what was going on. You know, I came back to the States, you know, a couple times a year and attended, you know, ASM or, you know, some meetings. So I kept in touch. So I was relieved that the progress wasn't as rapid as I had expected. So I didn't, so, you know, this is a realization I had afterwards, but, so, you know, it turned out to be not, I didn't really lose much time. Anything, you know, I also gained additional things because you know, I got interested in TB.
Okay.
And, you know, I was able to start a new program, so.
Yeah, okay, let me put in a new tape. Kay.